So I've been learning a lot about church history, obviously, putting these lessons together. I've also been learning some things about myself as a teacher and our kind of class dynamics. And one of the things is that you guys know a whole lot more about the Bible than you do about church history. And so our discussions have turned into what it feels like to me more of a lecture, because we don't seem to have as much foundation for discussion. So I am just inviting your interruptions, inviting your questions and discussion, understanding that there may just be less discussion, but also wanting to make that available, and we can slow things down if need be. We can change the pace if you do have questions. But I also understand maybe this is new enough to all of us that there's less discussion and less questions to be voiced. So far, we have talked about a whole variety of different things. We started, of course, in the book of Acts. We went on into the very first century of the church, understanding that the church was really born out of or in the midst of persecution. And we have seen kind of these waves of official and sometimes unofficial persecution really breaking over the church. And today we're going to come to what will be the end of official Roman empirical persecution. So we will be talking about the great persecution. This is the greatest time of persecution immediately preceded the ceasing of persecution of the church and really the elevation of the church in Roman society. And then we will end up talking about Constantine and his influence on really the church, Christianity, and Western society, European Western society, for, well, up to our own lifetimes. So Constantine is one of the turning points of not just world history, but church history. So, here we go. The Great Persecution, starting under Diocletian. So, after the persecution of Decius, the church experienced relatively peace and safety. In case you've forgotten, we covered the persecution under Decius last week, okay? I know these Roman Latin names, and, you know, it just is kind of starts to get muddled for us. But after that persecution under Decius and a couple of others, the church experienced relative peace and safety. And then Diocletian Diocletian became emperor in 284 AD and reigned until 305. So roughly 20 years. He reorganized the empire, and it was a time of renewed prosperity for the empire. So if you remember from any previous Western civilization class, they even teach that in high school anymore? I mean, so you may remember, you know, these various ups and downs in the Roman Empire, in the history of the Roman Empire. And so he is one of the so-called ups. And one of the reasons that there had been just cycle after cycle after cycle of turmoil was that the emperor would die and the process of succession was unclear. And therefore, the generals very often would just fight each other in a civil war until one of them became or appointed an emperor. And so Diocletian wanted to avoid that. So you can see there under his name, the fourth bullet point, his reorganization of the empire included setting up four emperors. And so they divided the empire into east and west, and there was a head emperor over the east and a head emperor over the west, and then a secondary emperor over each of the territories as well. So Diocletian himself was one of the head emperors, and Galerius was under him, and then Maximian ruled in the west with Constantius under him. And so think with me about sort of an imaginary map of Europe and the and Asia, kind of. So what we think of as Europe, of course, including Italy, the boot of Italy, the Mediterranean, of course, Rome, as in the Roman Empire, right? That was ruled by Maximian and Constantius. Now, Constantius, we're going to see in a moment, is the father of Constantine. All right, so this line is going to flow here in the West, and Constantine's strength was in the West once he takes the place of his father Constantius. And then in the East, thinking in terms of Asia Minor and kind of east of the Mediterranean, you had Diocletian and Galerius. And Diocletian is the ultimate final authority in the empire. But he has these two other he is one of the two head emperors in the east and west, and then there's an assistant emperor. And they are referred to as Augustus. That's the head emperors, and then the Caesar is the secondary emperor. So does all of that kind of make sense? All right, so among these four emperors of the empire, only one of them, Galerius, seems to have had any antipathy towards the Christians. On top of that, Diocletian's wife and his daughter were both Christians, and there were occasionally some, not a lot, but there were some high-ranking government officials who also were Christians. Now, in 295 AD, you can kind of see that there, in 295 AD, there were several Christians who were condemned to death, some because they refused to join the army, and others for trying to leave it. So, in general, among Christians at this time, they are at best ambivalent, pretty much kind of negative towards the army, towards being a soldier. So there's an emphasis on the more pacifistic kinds of passages that are in the scriptures. Now, granted, I mean, I think we can defend a theory of just war from Christian theology, but at this time in history, there was a little less of that. And there's a tendency towards pacifism among Christians. And so there are some people who are being conscripted, but they're saying, I'm a Christian and I should not bear the sword. So consequently, some of them were arrested and executed because they refused to serve. Others were in the army and became Christians and tried to leave because they also were being influenced by this more pacifistic strain among Christians at the time. And so both groups, some of them, were condemned to death for not participating in the military. And then, based on that, Galerius becomes concerned that at some point these Christians are going to be a real problem in society and especially in the army, because at some point they are going to decide that the commands of Christ preempt the commands of their general and they may not obey orders. And so you could imagine that the Roman army committed all kinds of atrocities, did they not? And they, you know, these soldiers could be commanded, go exterminate that village, men, women, and children. And they would back away and say, no, you know, we will only fight combatants, perhaps. Or they would just desert and leave if they felt like they could not obey the orders. And so he says, you know, we've got a problem within our midst. He might would have, if he had the terminology that we have today, he might would have considered them a fifth column. And said, we cannot tolerate this. So he convinced Diocletian to expel all the Christians from the army. And this was an edict of expulsion. However, apparently, some of the generals at the time decided, I don't want to get rid of all of these soldiers. I just want to get them to swear allegiance to the gods. I want them to deny Christ and swear their allegiance to the to the emperor, or perhaps to the army and to the army structure. And because these Christian soldiers would not deny their faith, some of them were executed. So that takes us up to 295. So 10 years into this reorganization, we've already had a couple of serious incidences of persecution. Then, in 303, Galerius convinced Diocletian to remove all Christians from the government positions, and they issued an edict that all Christian buildings and books be destroyed in the empire. Those Christians who would not turn over their sacred writings, those who would not hand over their Bibles, were arrested, condemned to torture, or to death. And we also need to remember that there are some historians, one of which is Eusebius, and eventually we will refer to Eusebius multiple times. But Eusebius was hired by Constantine to write history, the history of the church. And so Eusebius has a desire to make Constantine look good, and also to make his father, Constantius, look good. However, we do seem to see some indications in the history that if you look again at the division of the empire, this persecution is primarily over here in the east, and that in the west, Constantius is hesitant. He doesn't trust Galerius especially, and so he is hesitant to sort of pour on fuel to the fire and was reluctant to confiscate church buildings and confiscate Christian scriptures. And so there may have been some persecution, but it was more in the east than it was in the west. Eventually, two fires broke out in the palace. And remember that the head emperor, Diocletian, is served by Galerius, the one who is the most hateful towards Christians, and he keeps influencing Diocletian. So he convinces Diocletian that these fires have been set by Christians because they were in retaliation of their own buildings being burned. Some people even think that perhaps Diocletian himself set them, but of course that, who really knows what would have happened there. Nevertheless, Diocletian approved of a decree that all Christians in the imperial court would have to sacrifice to the gods. His wife and daughter immediately complied with that edict. However, the grand chamberlain, Dorotheus, was martyred during this time. So there is now an increasing level of pressure and martyrdom upon the church. That is a great question. I have no idea. I don't know what the Grand Chamberlain means. No, that would have been a government official. So he was he served the emperor in the government, in the palace. I'm thinking of it, if I understand some of the different meanings of Chamberlain, that he would have been serving not in the official hierarchy of the government, but serving in the hierarchy of the palace, meeting and organizing the personal needs of the court. This is still a guess, so don't quote me here, but, more than a butler, official position of authority, but household authority as opposed to governmental authority. That's, I'm pretty sure, but perhaps. But not a church official. Yeah, I'm pretty confident on that. So at that point, persecution broke out all over the empire as local governors, they just start to follow Diocletian. It doesn't always take an edict, go kill all the Christians. Right? They just like, oh, we want to please him, so we are going to do what he does. And they start to persecute Christians in their various government roles in their various regions. They put many believers to death. The Christians were beginning to be blamed for various disturbances around the empire. So at this point, Diocletian declares that all Christian leaders should be arrested and that all Christians must sacrifice to the gods. This was the worst persecution up until this point, and it is kind of the closing crescendo of persecution. Many Christians, so there had been a time of peace and really comfort for the Christian churches, and so many Christians, unaccustomed to the pressures of persecution, were unable or unwilling to stand strong in the persecution, and they left the faith, and they sacrificed to the gods of the Roman pantheon. Perhaps many of them repenting later, but many of them succumbed and offered sacrifices to the churches. Some of them were able to hide, and some of them fled. So you might think in our own day of Christians leaving Syria and fleeing to Jordan for their own safety. Some in the Roman Empire fled the persecution and settled in Persia, which in itself was problematic because they were already being accused of being traitors to the empire, and the primary threat to the empire from the east was Persia. Now, that doesn't count the quote-unquote Germanic tribes or the barbarians that are north in Europe, the northern European Germanic tribes. They also are a threat, but they're a threat in the east. And remember, this is all sort of bubbling out of, I'm sorry, they were a threat in the west. And this is all bubbling out of, this persecution is bubbling out of the east, where Diocletian and Galerius are. And Persia is the threat over there in the east. So it makes them look like, yes, we were right. They are traitors to the empire. Now, in 304, Diocletian got sick and abdicated the throne. Therefore, there was a great deal of political turmoil. Galerius became the primary Augustus. However, remember how we've talked about, both in modern times and in historical times, times of political turmoil meant that the Christians got a break, and that did not happen this time. The persecution continued in the east, but not quite as much in the west, again because of the distrust between the leaders of the west for the leaders of the east. During this time, Constantine, who is the son of Constantius, had been held in the court of Galerius, kind of a velvet prison, so to speak. He was really a captive in the court of Galerius so that he could hold that over his father's head and say, you know, you better do what I say. You better follow my lead in the empire, because remember, Constantine, your son, is over here with me, a long ways from home, and we can make life very difficult for him if you don't follow my lead. Well, Constantine escaped from the court and returned to his father's troops. When Constantius died, the troops themselves declared that Constantine was their only Augustus, that he was their only leader that they would, supreme leader that they would follow. At this point, a guy named Maximinus Daya is one of the four emperors, tried to have Christians put to work as slaves in stone quarries, but then the Christians just started organizing the first church of the stone quarry, and so he didn't know what to do, and he killed many of them or deported many of them, and the list of martyrs just continued to grow longer and longer. All right, any comments or questions? So, in the late 200s, early 300s, is the worst persecution that the church had faced up to that point from the Roman Empire. All right, on the back there. Finally, Galerius, remember, who had replaced Diocletian. Galerius became sick with a very painful disease, and eventually he became convinced by Christians who were basically preaching that God was judging him because of his persecution of Christians. He eventually changed his policy. And so in his edict, he said that Christians were to be pardoned, and they were allowed to be Christians once more. Once again, they were allowed to be Christians, as long as they did not interfere with the public order. And this is a quote from his edict. In return for our tolerance, Christians will be required to pray to their God for us, for the public good, and for themselves, so that the state may enjoy prosperity and that they may live in peace. This edict ended the worst of the persecution that the Christians had ever suffered under the Roman Empire. However, 5 days later, Galerius died from this disease. Some Christian leaders basically said, well, his repentance was too late, and God judged him anyway. So that is the end of most of it. However, we will see that there's some ongoing persecution until 313, although it has been greatly reduced. There are some agreements that are made, or edicts that are made that end persecution, official persecution altogether. So, Constantine, during this time of Galerius ruling and after his father's death, had been consolidating power and strengthening his troops in both Britain and Gaul, in the British Isles and in France. And he had been doing this for quite some time. In the turmoil that followed Galerius's death, he marched on Rome. And so the Maxentius is the ruler of the city of Rome. He is one of these four emperors that you will remember. And Constantine he's going to take over the entire western half of the empire. And he, for some reason, told his troops to paint a Christian symbol on their shields. And it essentially is two Greek letters, is what it is. And to us, it looks like a P superimposed over an X. But in Greek, it is a key and a row, which is a sort of like the equivalent of CHR. And whose name does that start? Christ. All right, and it's also the key and the row start the word Christos in Greek, and it was kind of taken as a Christian symbol. And he, for some reason, had them paint that on their shields, and then lo and behold, they were victorious. And so there are these various legends that he saw a cross in the sky, or that Christ appeared to him, or that his mother had seen something, or his wife had seen something. And so he sort of takes this over into his own sort of military philosophy, and he has them paint this Christian symbol onto their shields. He does end up conquering Maxentius. And then he made peace with the other emperor, Licinius. He's making peace by marching to war, right? Okay, so he makes peace at Milan in 313 AD, and part of the Edict of Milan included the agreement that persecution would stop. So 313 is the date that is normally given for the ending, the official ending of Roman persecution to Christians. It was more widespread and more long-lasting than the Edict of Galerius in the previous paragraph. All right, so any comments or questions? Go ahead. Yes, that is correct. So, two things kind of you're dealing with here. There would have been meetings in the catacombs at times, some hiding in the catacombs at times in Rome itself, in the city of Rome. Christians would have used that both as a burial place for martyred Christians, as well as sometimes a place to hide. We associate the Christians with the catacombs. Sort of the popular level of this is that they lived in and hid in the catacombs. What we know for sure from history is that they would sometimes celebrate communion on the date of martyrdom of one of these martyrs at their grave. And so, yes, they did go in and out of the catacombs and probably did hide there sometimes, but perhaps not to the romanticized level that we sometimes would believe. And then the symbol of the ichthus, it's been a while since I've kind of read the history of that, but if I remember correctly, it has something to do with the letters of spelling the word ichthus related. It has something to do with the letters of that word being related to the word Christ, I think, or something. I don't quite remember the details on that. Anybody remember? But it is the fish. We see it all the time. It is an ancient Christian symbol. Go ahead.
Yeah, the
Okay.
Was inside the fish. And from Renaissance folklore, I've heard that part of the reason that the fish was popular was because it was an early symbol of Christianity. It was an everyday symbol, it wasn't just a fish, but for Christians it meant fishing with men.
Okay. Right.
That easiest way to tell the Christians in town was to draw half of the
right.
fish, and Thor was coming up to draw the other half, so he was like, "Hi, fellow Christian."
Right, yes. Yes, I have heard that as well, that they could draw in the sand, you know, this arc, and then someone else could come along and draw the second arc to make that fish, and they would know that they were fellow believers. So perhaps it means that the acronym stands, they chose it as an acronym that stands for Jesus Christ, our Lord. Yeah, but I am, those are things that I have also heard but have forgotten. Yes. I don't know the place of his birth, but he... So you remember we talked about these four emperors. His father is one of the four. And then when his father dies, his father's troops swear allegiance to Constantine. So Constantine, by virtue of the vote of the military, so to speak, takes his father's place as one of the four emperors, and he consolidates power around himself, eventually defeating all the other extra emperors, and he once again is the sole emperor. So we, you know, the empire went through this period of more diverse power struggle, power separation, and he reassimilates all of that imperial power to himself. Really through the power of the military. Does that help you understand what?
But his father was hilarious.
That's correct. His father is a peer of Galerius, one of these other four emperors, and his father's name was Constantius. Any other comments or questions? All right, well, so Constantine's influence. The big question at this point in the story of Christianity is, how do those who claimed to be followers of a simple carpenter who himself was persecuted and martyred, how would they respond to being ushered so suddenly into the halls of power? Because Constantine not only lifts the pressure of persecution from them, frequently Christians are being elevated in the government, and he is doing a number of things to not just lift the pressure from Christians and from churches. He is also elevating them and giving them gifts and other things, so they become wealthy quickly. Let's cover a bit more history, and then we'll talk about Constantine specifically, and then we'll come back to that question. How do you think they're going to handle this? In 322 AD, Constantine invaded Licinius's territory. So remember, his power base is over here in the west, sort of southern Europe. And he invades the east, Licinius's space over here in the east, and on a pretext of chasing down a band of barbarians, a very convenient band of barbarians. Licinius interprets this as an invasion and sort of an intentional provocation, and he prepares for war, and Constantine is victorious in 324, and he rules the entire empire for another 13 years, which is at the time of his death. And it was a time of rebuilding and a time of peace. So Constantinople is built during this time. And just the story of the founding of Constantinople, it was a relatively small city. It was not big enough for the grandeur that it wasn't even called Constantinople. I mean, obviously, Constantinople. He's renaming this smaller city. And so he gets a stick, and he sort of under the direction of God, so to speak, he gets this stick and he draws these lines. He marches way out into the countryside and draws these lines. This is where the new walls, the new city walls are going to be. And everybody is just aghast. How can this city be so large? And it turns out that there are so many social benefits to moving to Constantinople. You get tax relief, you get free flour, you get, it's kind of the breadline of the empire. And so you get all these social benefits for coming to Constantinople that even those walls weren't big enough to contain the people that were flocking to Constantinople. At the same time, he wants to make it a grand palatial city. And so he goes throughout the empire, he sends people throughout the empire, and they are robbing the various pagan temples of their various idols, really, their statues of the various gods. So in some ways the beautiful artwork of the various sculptors is being robbed from all around the empire and brought unceremoniously to Constantinople and set up. And in some ways, that kind of is a picture of the pagan gods sort of losing their power. They're just picking them up and carting them off as a museum piece, so to speak. And on one of them, one of the most important statues, Constantine had the head whacked off and an image of his own head stuck on it, And not only that, it's way up in the air. It's like 45 feet up in the air because it's on a column, which is on a pedestal, which is, it's kind of cheap art, and a little bit seemingly that there's no longer any reverence for these old pagan gods. At the same time, by moving the capital of the empire away from the city of Rome, he is decreasing the power of the old Roman nobility, these powerful noble families that had been members of the Senate and had upheld the power of Roman society. They were all pagans. They all worshipped these pagan gods. And so he does an end run around them. He says the capital city's not going to be here anymore. And their power is dramatically reduced, and therefore their power of their religion is dramatically reduced as he just moves everything over to Constantinople. As a part of his sort of empire renewal program, unlike previous emperors, they were always, remember this, they were always going back and saying, all right, if we want to unite the empire, and if we want to re-strengthen the empire, we need to go back to the glory days. Go back to the for us it would be the Leave It to Beaver days, right? Go back to the glory days when everybody prayed to the gods, and they would try to force people to pray to the gods, sacrifice to the gods, and burn incense to the emperor. We've been over this again and again and again, and that would restart the persecution, right? Well, this time, Constantine decides, phooey on that old plan. We are going to reunite the empire around Christianity. And so he has a very different plan in some ways because of the object, Christianity, but the same old plan, religiously unite the empire, but instead do it this time around Christianity. This elevated Christianity, this elevated Christians in many, many ways as a part of his, essentially, his empire, empirical renewal program. Now, let me, any comments or questions? So some of this I've kind of already covered. Look at Constantine's conversion. Constantine was not actually baptized until his deathbed. In many ways, I think we can say that he was using Christianity and Christians with varying levels of sincerity on his own part to accomplish his own political ends. Yeah. Okay.
That's what I was making there. I believe that's why last minute
Yes. Would have to be paid for in purgatory. Okay. Yes, Roman Catholicism, you start to see this right here on this. Yeah. Right, so he's waiting. Okay. So what's that? Right. So his late baptism would have been because they were expecting those sins to be washed away prior to baptism, so that the one after, not so. So you can see how it's losing its symbolism for conversion, and it's beginning to be, they're seeing baptism as a saving ceremony. Okay. Now, however, I mean, I don't want to give him too much credit here. However, up until that time of his baptism, he continued to participate in pagan rituals. He continued to lead pagan rituals, and he considered himself the high priest of Roman paganism. And these things, I am assuming, probably would have been related to military. You know, that they would have, you know, prior to a battle, there would have been certain rituals that they would have participated in. However, he did many, really just, God did graciously use him to give freedom to the church. So after his victories over Maximius and Licinius, he immediately ended this residual persecution of the church. He began gifting property to the church, such as the Lateran Palace, which apparently had belonged to his wife. He gave that to the church in Rome. But of course, what's he doing? To the church in Rome. What's he doing? You know, he's giving them something in the old capital back in Rome. But nevertheless, he did appoint various Christians to high positions in the government. In 324 AD, he ordered that all soldiers worship the supreme God on the first day of the week. And it seems to me from history that worshiping the supreme God could mean worshiping the God of the Bible, or it could mean worshiping the all-conquering sun, which was kind of a deity that previous emperors had associated with for, you know, uniting the empire. And so some were worshiping God, and some were worshiping a false god. And some of them probably just did it because, like at boot camp where John is at right now, you get a break from chores if you go to chapel. So almost all Marines go to chapel. All right. And then I've already mentioned how he decreased the influence of the old Roman aristocracy, who were all primarily pagan, by moving the capital of the empire to Constantinople. All of this newfound peace and prominence influenced the church dramatically. So, Christian worship began to include formal and luxurious garments. So, such things as impressive robes, gold jewelry, chalices and trays, and accoutrements that are more like the Old Testament temple than the New Testament church. Okay? So they have the resources now to formalize and to make worship luxurious. Christian worship began to include physical gestures, such as genuflecting, that would normally have been a show of reverence for the emperor. So if you went into the palace and into the presence of the king, you would have knelt. You perhaps would have kissed the ring of the emperor, and now you're doing that before the bishop, perhaps. And then the Christian worship began to include such things as processionals and incense and relics of the martyrs. And so let me start with relics there. Constantine's mother, Helena, made it a big project of hers to build some churches. So she built a church in Jerusalem. This is commonly well known. She built this church in Jerusalem and lo and behold found a piece of Christ's cross. And then various other relics, including pieces of Christ's cross, began to pop up all over the empire here and there, and there were said to be miraculous powers if you prayed near a relic, if you prayed or had communion near a relic. There were there was a special spiritual power in that. Incense, of course, the sort of the smells and bells. You've seen video probably of Catholic communion, so this would have come in about this time. They would have a sort of a swinging little pot of incense and bells to ring, as well as processionals. So they would take what Catholics now call the host, which is the bread of communion. They would hold it over their head and walk down the aisle of the church, you know, kind of what they believe that they were doing at the time and are doing is elevating the body of Christ for all to see and even to worship. And so, although these things would be very, very foreign to us, I mean, we roll the bread and juice in on a little cart, you know, fairly unceremoniously compared to this, you know, but many, many people, even today, attend some kind of formal liturgical church where they do that. They, in these grand robes, carry the host, carry that bread down the aisleway of the church. And then the physical buildings became more ornate and more luxurious. So any comments or questions there? Go ahead, Greg. I am unsure when the doctrine called transubstantiation came in, but technically, Roman Catholicism, medieval Roman Catholicism believed, and Roman Catholicism today, as far as I know, still believes, that it actually becomes the body and blood of Christ at some point when the priest, I think, prays over it. Or maybe lifts it up or something. What's that? Blesses it or whatever. It would be more like at the altar. Yeah. The other thing that's kind of interesting about medieval Catholicism is they forbid the congregation to take the wine. The blood of Christ was too sacred. And only the priest drank it. And of course, the best wine in Italy showed up there, you know. And you ended up with, and they often, and you couldn't waste it. You couldn't pour the blood of Christ down the drain. So there were a lot of Sunday afternoon drunken priests. Yeah. So, yeah. So I don't really know for sure the answer to your question.
Even now, the priest will place the wafer on the tongue of the person that comes up so it won't be dropped.
Yes. That still have relics, you mean?
Oh, yeah.
I really don't know. However, Heather has got this, she says. She knows the answer. Okay, go ahead. About relics, are there other countries that are filled with relics?
Okay. Italy has a whole bunch. The Greek Orthodox Church has a whole bunch.
Okay, so great answer. Yes, lots of other relics all over the place in Europe as well as Eastern Orthodoxy, apparently, as well. People would make pilgrimage and et cetera, et cetera. Yes, which unfortunately something similar happens out on Highway 41. There's no relics out there, but people visit those stations of the cross, the Christ, the Passion of the Christ, or whatever those stations are, and pray and say prayers and leave flowers and pray the rosary, etc., in an attempt to win God's approval. Yeah. Other comments or questions? We are getting close to the end of our time, but I really would like us to sort of just discuss and think together, maybe at the beginning of next week, you know, what do you think is happening here? As what are your thoughts and observations about as Christianity rises to prominence, we see some problems, don't we? And we see, in some sense, the purification of the church under persecution, which is going to be sporadic, if at all, for many centuries. Yeah.
Well, but when you look at history, the times that the church is historically in power over the government or has high place within the government, they become very secular.
Right.
Much more, look at what we can do.
Yes. Yes.
Like you see what happened during communist East Europe. They lost their power, they became terrified, and then when they were under persecution, they took a hard look at themselves and said, maybe we should take a look at what we're doing spiritually in our own lives.
Yes, there can be imbalances in both directions. So I also, like the Baptists in Romania, are notorious for fighting with each other. they kind of became insulated, and there it was a protectionistic instinct, and they tended to debate one another more than they should have. But nevertheless, there was a strength that was there because they were facing that persecution. Don, did you have something that you wanted to say? The Council of Nicaea. And presided at part of that council, yes.
And if it's all kind of divisions, you know, later on you become archbishop if you're the bishop of Rome or Jerusalem.
Then, right. At Endemont. Yes.
And who runs the church? The secular ruler?
Right. So most historians / sort of Christian observers of current culture would say this, that we have come to the end of the Constantinian period. In other words, the power of the church in sort of prominence and in government and in secular society has been declining and is basically now removed. All right, and that we have come to the end of Christendom, and we have come to the end of the Constantinian period. You will sometimes read in the literature the post-Constantinian period. It's a way of saying the post-Christian period in many ways, and we have entered into that. I mean, we're lucky that we can still meet freely. But here's the illustration that I love to use about this, and I think I've used it before. You guys all remember Judge Roy Moore, who fought to keep the Ten Commandments in his courtroom. Does anybody know what they did with those Ten Commandments when he lost that battle? They rolled them into the broom closet and left them there. And that is what essentially has happened to Christians in our culture. And we have, I think, to be honest, the opportunity and the privilege to minister the gospel from the position of the broom closet, which is a lot closer to what Christ and the apostles did than what archbishops have done for 1,000 years. Or more since Constantine, and that when we become weak, Christ, God shows His power, and there are blessings to having full Christian freedom and a certain amount of power in the culture, but there are also dangers to that. There are also opportunities that will come to us when we are more like the ancient Christians, experiencing some stress as a Christian church, God will use us, perhaps in ways we've not known before in our own lifetimes. Yes. Okay. On the seventh day. Yes.
Part of your thing here talks about Constantine starting worship
It's all Constantine's fault.
All his fault for starting worship on the first day of the week.
Right. Yes. The Lord's Day, yes. So thank you for giving me an opportunity to defend why we meet on Sunday. Because although we're not arguing with pagans, we do occasionally run into Seventh-day Adventists. And why in the world do we worship on Sunday when the Bible says to worship on Saturday? Not the first day. The Bible says the seventh day. So we know that John refers in the book of Revelation to being in the Spirit on the Lord's Day. He was making some attempt to worship God on the Lord's Day. There was a habit in the early church of meeting in the synagogue. So these would have been originally mostly Jewish Christians. You know, we know that it expands out to Gentiles as well. But at the very earliest, there's a predominance of Jewish Christians. They meet on Saturday in the synagogue with their Jewish friends and family members. And then they also meet together exclusively as Christians and receive communion on Sunday because it's the day of the Lord's resurrection. Eventually, they get kicked out of the synagogue. And this is within the first 100 years. They get kicked out of the synagogue. Probably has happened by the time John writes the book of Revelation. They're kicked out of the sort of the comfort zone of the synagogue. Even politically, there's some comfort zone that goes with that. And when they get kicked out of the synagogue, they worship exclusively on Sunday, and that happened at least 200 years before Constantine. So it's just a false perspective on history. Right. Yeah. You won't win the argument. Right. Absolutely. He is our Sabbath. He is our Sabbath. Yeah. And I can get a little feisty about that. When people try to get me to keep laws that have been fulfilled in Christ, I want to eat bacon. I mean, I eat bacon anyway, but I want to eat more bacon, you know, and catfish and other such things that that Seventh-day Adventist would require that you keep. Yeah. I started to say eat bacon and smoke a pipe, but I don't smoke, and it would kill me if I did. So, all right. Well, we've gone over already, but we can kind of return to that. That is an important discussion, and I would be happy to make up from some of the lack of our discussion in previous weeks by kind of mulling over this sort of Constantinian influence a bit more next week. You are dismissed.